Hello, I'm James Sandy.
And I'm Steve Pitt.
And we are All About the Songwriter,
show dedicated to songwriting talent from in and around the Portsmouth area.
So what are we up to, Steve? What are we going to regale people with across this series of programmes?
There's been lots of competitions over the years that have primarily been aimed at Battle of the Bands, so band-related stuff, and we thought it'd be kind of nice to celebrate some of the songwriting talent in the area, which is mainly involves sort of the solo artists who can tend to be the unsung heroes, in a way.
And we've got a real variety, haven't we? A real cast of talent coming up over the next few months.
We have. I mean, the first four programmes all showcase previous winners of All About the Song, local songwriting competition that we've run at the Cellars for the last 4 years, this being the fifth year. And the winners have all been very different in their songwriting styles, but all very much talented and have gone on to further themselves in the business as a result of winning it.
And we're going to interrogate them, we're going to quiz and query them on some of their influences and I think hopefully some of the motives behind some great songs and songwriting.
Yes, I mean we all hear songs at gigs all the time, but sometimes it's fascinating to dig just a little bit deeper and find out where the song came from, what inspired it in the first place, and also what that artist grew up listening to and where that songwriting talent's developed from, what the roots of it all.
So stay tuned to All About the Songwriter, where you can hear some great music, local and influential, and we're going to kick off this series of programmes very excitingly with Loz Bridge. Now, Loz Bridge is someone that came up on your radar a few years ago, Steve?
Yes, he moved down to Portsmouth and from Preston and settled down here for a while. He has now moved on to Bristol, but while he was in Portsmouth, he certainly made a big impact. First off, playing in a band and then going solo, and probably best remembered for Loz Bridge and the Box Social. And then as a solo songwriter, entered All About the Song and won it in its first year.
And obviously Bristol is a long way from here, so we employed some telephony, and here's how we got on. So by the magic of technology, down through the telephone wire, we have Loz Bridge. Loz, welcome.
Hello, yeah, thank you very much.
How are you doing? You keeping well?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, thank you, James. I'm very well, thanks.
Creatively and artistically, you are doing very well, I think it's fair to say.
Vibrant, yeah, creatively vibrant.
Vibrant. So welcome to the show. It's a new show, All About the Songwriter, mm-hmm. and we're keen to find out all about you and your motivations and some of your influences, let alone some mm-hmm. of the great product that you've been putting out.
The selection that you've chosen to put across from your own songwriting, Loz, most of those are newer tracks.
Yeah.
So is there a reason why you're sort of stepping away from the older material?
Well, I've just been played quite a lot. Obviously, like the Express has put some of those tracks out in the past. I haven't really had the newer tracks played that much. But also, it is quite a different style. So just quite keen to put that out. It's obviously what I'm passionate about at the moment is a slightly different direction and motivation behind songwriting, so that's mainly where my head's at the moment, so that was I was quite keen to talk about what I'm doing at the moment, really.
It was quite a big shift, I think, wasn't there, when you moved cities?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I used to live in Portsmouth, obviously. I was there for like 7 years, I think, in total, and then made the decision to move over to Bristol, which has obviously got a real rich songwriting tradition, and it was a musical tradition in general, and it seemed like a fantastic place to go. And since coming to Bristol, I think this was also maybe a direct influence of the competition in a way, was that I came here with the intention to gig, but that didn't happen for one reason or another when I got here. I was just tied up in the actual move itself, and then came to the decision to actually focus on the songwriting and step back from the performance a little bit, and that's really what's driven me for the last 3 years, really, since being in Bristol.
Was it useful to kind of be forced into that as you were?
Definitely, yeah, absolutely, because it wasn't my decision. As I said, I wanted to get here and start gigging straight away. It didn't really happen, and so I think that was actually quite a good thing that I had that period of time, that by the time I was in a position to actually get out and gig, which is probably 9 or 10 months of having been here, it was like, oh, actually, I'm finding that I really enjoy this other aspect of doing this now, and I've sort of gained a lot more confidence in doing it and in doing the songwriting. And it was like, oh, wow, I don't think that maybe would have happened if I'd have just been able to get here and start gigging immediately. So it was maybe quite good to get some perspective on it in that way.
It's interesting, because I was going through some old emails the other day,
yeah.
And I found one that I'd sent out when the Cellars was at the time under threat of closure.
Yes, yeah.
And your reply to that email, when I read it back, was actually you deciding drunken that you were going to move away.
Is that
and
right?
That was just before you won All About the Song. So that was very much part of that process.
That's
wasn't it?
Really interesting. Yeah, yeah, that is really interesting. It was, I mean, I'd say the decision to move away was partly the music thing. Obviously, I'd had a fantastic time in being a part of the Portsmouth music scene, which is incredibly vibrant, a lot going on in Portsmouth, but it was also, I felt like I wanted to get away and explore a different scene somewhere else, and Bristol seemed like a really good choice. And as you say, it was like, I always loved the songwriting, it was always great, but it's sort of, to have someone tell you you're good at this through something like this, where you're up against people who you really respect, and to all of a sudden come out on top of that and have people say you have something here, you have sort of a product which is good. It sort of makes you look at it and go, oh yeah, maybe I'm not that bad, you know. maybe this could work.
One of the judges that year was Neil Ferris, wasn't it? The former head of EMI.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
So nice to get that kind of recognition.
Yeah,
for
definitely
sure.
Neil, and I think it was Chesney Hawkes as well, who you'd been doing some work with, and I can't remember who the last guy was.
Chris Difford, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and to get some really positive comments, and as you say, definitely from someone like Neil Ferris, who's been in that position, it was like, oh, wow, objectively, if I can get those opinions from those kind of people, it's like, yeah, wow, maybe there's something in this.
And I think with the songwriting, when you've done, for example, Down by the River, which you did with Suburbian, and then you flipped it and did it with The Box Social, you turned it from being sort of a rock song into more of a roots song.
That one, doing the stuff with Suburbian, that was obviously quite a big... expansive, like rock sound. I was really happy with all those songs. I was really pleased, and I was happy that that's where those songs should sit. But By the River was the only one that I wrote as a sort of a quirky, odd, eerie folk song, and then that sort of went through the Suburbian mill and got changed into a rock song. But that was the only one that I ever niggled me really in my head, and I thought, it's not supposed to be like this. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Even though it got a really good response as a rock song, and I did like it like that. That was the only one where I came out where I thought that one, I know for sure that's going to work the way I heard it. So that was the only one of those songs that I carried over into The Box Social.
Well, funny enough, I thought about you on Saturday because I was up at Cropredy Festival, and Nick Kershaw played The Riddle with Fairport Convention with no synthesizers or drum machines or anything. It was with fiddles and double basses and flutes. So it just goes to show that really, I mean, the whole point of this program is the fact that good songwriting is good songwriting in whatever format.
You should be, absolutely, like for a song to be good, you should be able to sit down with an acoustic guitar and play it, and it should work at that level. But that sounds absolutely incredible. It must have sounded amazing.
So when you made that switch, really, from kind of deciding to focus more on writing the songs, presumably you still needed to take some of the fledgling songs out and about and perform them. And there's a dynamic to that, I guess. Well, you know, once you sort of, not just a reaction to the song from the audience, but playing them in, you know, rather than sitting it on your own in your bedroom, as it were, playing them in a kind of, you know, auditorium.
Do you know what? I did for a while, James. I did a few gigs here in Bristol and took them out, but I have almost completely moved away from that now, to the point that maybe a little bit too much, because if I ever perform in public now, it's terrifying, like the way it used to be. So I got so I was gigging an awful lot and got really relaxed with that point of view. But I don't really rely on an audience anymore, and it's maybe good and bad. Like you take your songs out and they'll get seasoned because you're playing them in front of an audience. But also, if you're not doing that and you're writing for something else, it's like at the moment I'm writing for stuff which myself and my producer friend are pitching on purpose for TV and films and stuff like that. You don't have a live audience in mind. It's sort of a different way of writing. You don't have any limits. In the same way that you don't have to be able to sit down with an acoustic guitar and play it from start to finish, even though you should obviously be able to do that. But it's sort of liberating in a way. Do you know what I mean? That you're thinking, at the end of this process, I'm not going to have to sit on a stool and play this in front of an audience, which always used to be on my mind. It's sort of nice not to have that restriction there. But on the flip side of that, you're not getting that immediate feedback from an audience hating a song or loving a song or whatever.
It's interesting you mentioned the kind of film association. I think Tindersticks recently have been doing some stuff which is purely for film, kind of generated for up-and-coming films or films in process.
Yeah.
Sometimes, I guess, artists either write stuff and then it instantly fits in a director's mind, and that's the song I want to use. But more and more, you've got directors working with artists to come up with music for the film.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a comment that I always got all the way down the line about my songwriting. People always said that would be good in films. That's filmic, or it's like, it's visual. I'd always said about my lyrics, it's visual. It would sit well in films, and that was always something I wanted to get into. But it's interesting now writing stuff on purpose for this, like having a brief and going. But it's the first time I've ever really done this. I never used to do this at all. Sit down and go, we need a song that it's about this. It sounds like this, or it's is, or what you'll find most of all, is that music supervisors will want a song that sounds like this song because they can't afford Coldplay, do you know what I mean? So they want a song that sounds like Coldplay. So it's really interesting to be able to tell, we want a song that sounds like this. Because from the way that I approach songs, I still haven't got to a stage yet, and I don't think maybe I'd ever want to, where I can just completely detach myself and just write a pop song that sounds like it. There has to be something in it for me. I have to believe in the message, and it has to move me. It has to make the hairs on the back of my neck stand up to a certain point. So it's interesting walking that fine line of trying to hit a brief that somebody's given to you, but also like believing in the product at the end of the day. It's a curious thing. But yeah, you're right. It's a lot of times you will maybe look back over your old stuff and go, that with the little tweak, that would work well, that would work for this, or that would work for that, or maybe not. You never quite know though what's going through a music supervisor's head. You really don't. They'll have something so specific in mind, and if one word in your track is wrong, then it won't make the cut. I don't know. All you can really do is just keep on doing what you're doing and hoping some of it fits somewhere, you know, hoping some of it lands.
And you also mustn't give up on stuff that you've already done.
Yep.
Because I mean, just recently I was involved in something where a track that was written 40 years ago was suddenly picked up and put on an American TV show, just completely cold out of nowhere.
It's
suddenly
incredible.
A phone call came in, can we use this track? And it was written in 1972.
Yeah.
So you might have to wait a while.
No, that's it. That's absolutely right. And it's stuff like that, because the way the business works, the way the syncing business works, these guys need these tracks in a matter of hours. Literally, that's how it works sometimes. So it's having your stuff ready to go all the time. Because as you say, there might be a TV show that's going on that's, I don't know, that's set in the 50s or something like that, and they'll be looking for rockabilly music, and they'll be saying, like, find me right now songs that fit this brief. And if yours happens to fit that brief at that time, they'll call up and they'll say, we need this in the next 8 hours to use it.
Let's talk about one of your tracks. Steve and I have divvied up some of the suggestions that you gave us. It's all prepared. We've all done our homework. And Steve, you got the first one that you want to ask Loz about.
Yeah, the first one we're going to look at is Stories, that Jazz Morley co-write that you've done. And that sort of opens up the point of discussion that, you know, of these tracks that you sent over, two of them are co-writes. So that's something that is newer to you, isn't it? You weren't co-writing
absolutely
much before.
Never done that before at all. But when the period of time that I was talking about before, when I first moved to Bristol, and then during that period of time made the decision that I want to start writing rather than performing, and obviously that involves writing for other people and with other people, and that was a completely new world to me, and I thought, well, how on earth am I going to start this? But obviously through gigging around the Portsmouth scene, I've become friendly with a lot of different musicians, and Jazz Morley was someone who I had gigged with before. I'd supported her a couple of times, and the same with Becky Jerems, who I'm assuming you're also going to have on this program.
That
it was just somebody I knew well and had and sort of respected their songwriting and their performing, and it was sort of a natural course just to pick up the phone and say, I want to be a songwriter. Can I write a song with you, please? And so I did have quite a few with Jazz. Like, she was great. She just said, yeah, come down and see what we can do. And we did a few. I think this was on our third session, maybe. We wrote some songs before this, and I sent over this idea to her, and she loved it straight away. She really latched onto it. It was just like a verse and a chorus or something. So then I went over to her, and we worked on it, and we finished it together, and I was so pleased with this track. It was, it was really good how it came out.
And it's now gone through full production with Kipper, the Grammy Award-winning producer.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
I'm glad you clarified that, because I thought it was the cartoon dog.
Yeah, he's really come on leaps and bounds.
Yeah,
Jazz knew Kipper, and I knew Kipper strangely through a different method. I knew his brother. His brother's a drummer, and I'd jammed with him for years and knew him anyway. But Jazz got in touch with Kipper through a different route, and he got on board to produce this track, which we were so delighted about. Kipper's been involved with some pretty big names. He did the Brand New Day album for Sting, and he's been involved with Gary Newman and various people over the years. So we were so excited to have him involved. And one of the best days of my life, I think, was when they called up and said, we're going to do a live string arrangement for this track. Do you want to come down and see us record the strings? And that was just breathtaking, to see a couple of live string players, serious professional girls who played the cello and the violin on this track. And that was just breathtaking to see that being recorded.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to that track now.
Cool.
I've only ever heard about love and stories. I can't be sure, but I guess it would feel like falling. With butterflies and sparkling eyes and thunder rolling where there once was rain. And every time I stumble, someone's there to help me up again. And the roller coaster you're supposed to ride between joy and pain. One day I'll be ready for love and all its glory.
Listening to All About the Songwriter with me, James Sandy.
And me, Steve Pitt.
And on the line, kind of live from Bristol, Loz Bridge. Welcome back, Loz. We're going to talk about some of your influences now. And I'm interested to know, I mean, obviously they are influences, but I'm interested to know how some of the songs that you've selected actually shape your music. You know, it's a difficult question because, you know, there's so many kind of ways that people filter out different things from different sounds. But how do you think that some of these artists and some of these tracks that you've chosen are reflected in your work?
I think it's as simple as that it's you admire qualities in other songwriters, and then when you come to look at your own craft, you want to it's those same qualities that you admire that you've seen in other people that you want to bring out. And when it comes to the sort of selection process, if you like, of when you're sitting down writing a song and making one choice or another choice, you will make those choices based on what you respect and admire. So it's not quite as cold-hearted as saying, well, I like this guy, he sings like this, so I'm going to sing like this. But it's just that because you admire the things that he does, that they're the kind of things that you will tend to do in your own songwriting. There's that, and there's also, I always think your influences, like be it through other musicians or be it through life or be it through other things you've seen or read or whatever, come in subliminally so many times. If there's something I'm writing about that's an incident from my life, it usually won't come out in the songwriting until sort of 6 or 8 months down the line, and it's very rarely planned. I very rarely will sit down and go, I want to write something about this thing that's happened. I'll just find it coming out naturally. It seems to be a sort of a process that happens in the subconscious. And I think the same is probably true of your musical influences.
Well, let's start then with the first selection that you've made, which is Rufus Wainwright's 14th Street. Now, in some of the notes you passed us, this is clearly one song that knocks you over.
Yeah, absolutely. I first discovered Rufus Wainwright, I think it was probably about 6 or 7 years ago or something. I was just watching TV with a mate in Portsmouth, and he came on just a little clip of one of his live shows. We were just absolutely floored. It was just him playing a piano and a really simple song called Vibrate, which is from the same album that 14th Street is from, and it was just like, wow. That doesn't happen very often, where you see something and go, you see 20 seconds of it and go, I've got to find out what that is, because that is just phenomenal. Like, I haven't heard anything like this before. Then went and got the album and looked up that live concert, and I've just been in love with Rufus Wainwright and his music and everything he does ever since. It's just, you just know sometimes when you discover an artist, and you just know, unless they do something horrifically wrong, I'm going to buy everything that this guy does forever. And it really, I get so excited when there's a new Rufus Wainwright album coming out or anything he does. It's just the most elegant, beautiful, clever songwriting you'll ever hear. And from this album, Want One, and the following album, Want Two, I think was him at his best. And I actually saw him playing in Preston, funnily enough, on the last night of this tour when he was touring these two albums.
And that was around sort of 2004 or 2005, I think?
Yeah, about that time, yeah. And it was just fun. That's definitely my sort of top three gigs that I've ever seen, that one. It just absolutely, the band was perfect, beautiful band with a double bass and a string section, and just absolutely perfect. Yeah, I would say he's definitely someone who I absolutely aspire to be. And we're talking about choices and songwriting before, he's definitely someone who sort of would inspire me to constantly do better, because he's someone who you listen to, that, like this track, 14th Street, is so clever, just so beautiful in the way that it's put together. You will listen to it and go, I need to do better, because there's someone out there who's doing so much better than me. Do you know, if I want to do anything, if I want to get anywhere close to this, I need to do a lot better. So he's definitely someone who inspires me to improve.
There's also a banjo solo on this particular track, which I think his late mother actually contributed to the album, which is a fact I dug out.
I didn't know that was Kate McGarrigle playing the banjo on this track.
Apparently she did, yeah. And that's, it's kind incredible. Of, it's woven sort of, right, and there's a solo in the middle, but it's woven throughout.
It's not like a Led Zeppelin solo, it's not right out there, it's not in your face. But
I think it's up there with banjo solos that I'm aware of.
Well, top 10?
Top, yeah. It's got to be in there with Kermit the Frog, I'm sure. It's there somewhere.
Yeah, I did not know that, so I've learned something new today. I didn't know that was Kate McGarrigle on the banjo.
All right, excellent. Let's just have a quick snippet of that track.
Brilliant.
Okay, so we're going to move now to your next influence. The next artist that you've chosen is Paul Simon.
Yep.
Which, a track, The Obvious Child.
Yep.
Now, I think when people hear this, they instantly think, oh, wasn't Graceland a great album?
Yes.
But it's not from Graceland, it's from his other album, The Rhythm of the Saints.
It does sound so much tied in with that same sound as Graceland. You can see why so many people think that. And it's like, it wasn't maybe, when you think of Paul Simon, there were so many choices I could have made from Graceland, the Graceland, The Boy in the Bubble, or the things like Homeward Bound or something. They're all such beautiful tracks. But this one, for some reason, has always really resonated with me, and it's one that you don't always get cited as one of his obvious choices. I just absolutely love it. It's really indicative of one of these tracks that if you see interviews with him and you understand how he builds up songs, it was very definitely built from the bottom up, from the from the groove upwards. You can obviously tell that the groove has started with these incredible African drummers playing the groove, and then the song built on top of it. But Paul Simon, again, like Rufus Wainwright, is someone I respect so much. I think the thing that we were talking about influences before, that Paul Simon has influenced me, is the cadence of his speech, the rhythms of his speech patterns. I find absolutely intriguing. And when you listen to it, it doesn't sound like he's doing anything clever. It actually, quite the opposite. It sounds like he's throwing lines away. Mm. But if you try and cover a Paul Simon song, you soon realize how difficult that is to do, to make it sound so effortless as the way he's doing here. In the way he fits so much, like it's so verbose, his lyric writing, the way he fits so many incredibly clever lyrics into quite a short space, and it's not on the beat or behind the beat. It really just plays around the beat, the way that the lyrics are syncopated with the rhythm, in a way that I just find entrancing, and that's something that definitely has influenced the way that I put lyrics to music.
It's a really interesting record, I think, for me, because it's one of those records where a Western artist attempts to, I think, create a gateway into the kind of world music scene, and he'd obviously followed up Graceland with this record.
Yes.
But more with a kind of, I suppose, Latin American, Brazilian feel.
That's right.
But then you've got kind of East and West African drumming and bits added in as well. So there's a real kind of mix of...
It is, yeah. You get the feeling as well. I mean, you never quite know, obviously. But again, just from watching interviews and for seeing how he approaches music, you don't get the feeling that he set out to create a gateway, as you said, to the different cultures. Although that is what I think what he did. But you don't get the feeling that he did that. You get the feeling that he's just incredibly passionate about music. He loves different styles of music, and he just really connected with the sound that these guys were making, and it really was just the case of let's get together and make some music, and then afterwards see what we can make out of it. And I mean, that's the most fascinating thing about the Graceland, is the way that it was obviously they just recorded hours and hours and hours and hours of music, and then took that out and sliced it up and made songs out of it, which is even more amazing that these songs sound so crafted, so intentionally crafted. But when you know that's the way they put together, it's even more incredible. And as I say, the way that his lyrics seem so effortless on top of it, you think it could have been done no other way than to have been meticulously crafted from day one. But it just sort of shows the power of getting in the groove and in the moment and trusting that will do the right thing, and it really has in this case.
I mean, you talked about the kind of cadence and the delivery of it. Do you think you've picked up elements of that, not necessarily in your sound, but in terms of, you know, how you've rhythmically approached
I would
songs?
Like to think so, and I think it's really funny. Andy Foster, who is a good friend of mine, who's a guitar player and singer-songwriter around Portsmouth, who I always used to jam with, and he played guitar for me and played piano for him. Whenever he tried to do one of my tracks, he would say they're really difficult to do, that they're difficult to sing, the songs, because I place words in peculiar places. But to me, it doesn't sound peculiar, it sounds natural. And I like to play around with that. I don't like to put the lyrics in the obvious places, or like to for the words to land in the obvious places. I like the way that the lyrics fall to be almost percussive and to play against the beat sometimes. I find stuff like that fascinating.
Well, let's hear all those elements beautifully drawn together. This is Paul Simon and The Obvious Child.
When we were putting this together and you were sending across the information, Loz, I said to James that there's undoubtedly going to be a Tom Waits song in there, and there is, and you've chosen Make It Rain.
Yeah.
And I think if anybody's ever seen you play and see the feel that you have and the real roots influences that you have, then it would be no surprise that Tom Waits is one of those influences.
Yep.
How far back does that go?
I can pinpoint almost exactly. I think it goes back to about 2002 when I was first. I was living in Amsterdam actually at the time, and I didn't even know that Tom Waits was a musician, but I knew him as an actor, bizarrely enough, and because he's been in a lot of films, like never really as a leading role, but he's an exceptional supporting actor. And my boss at the time put on a track from the album Blood Money, I think, and I was like, what is this? And he said, oh, it's Tom Waits, you might have seen, he was in Dracula and stuff. Oh my God, is that guy? And again, the same thing with the Rufus Wainwright thing, was just instantly, what is this? I need to find out what this is. And they just went on a buying spree and bought everything I could get hold of. He's got like 20 odd albums or something, because he has been producing, he's I don't know, probably in his 70s, maybe 60s or 70s. Now, he's been producing music since he was in his early 20s. And again, when you hear the song that this guy was recording in his 20s, you just think, well, what's the point? Why bother? The music that was flowing out of this guy when he was at such a young age, from such an old mind, it seems, like, it's just absolutely incredible. But I was hooked from then on. And I think I saw him live. I've seen him live twice, but I saw him live, first of all, in 2004 when he did the Real Gone tour, which this tune, Make It Rain, is from. And you have to remember, at that time, there was no YouTube or anything similar. Now, if you want to see an artist, you go on YouTube, you can see him live. But at that time, I'd only ever seen... He didn't really have any live videos or anything like that, or didn't at the time. I'd only ever seen a picture of him on the front of the album, so I didn't know what he looked like, really, in performance or anything like that. And I bought a ticket, or like he toured Europe, which he hadn't done for about 18 years, I think, at the time. And my girlfriend at the time like knew how much I wanted to see him. His tour, European tour, sold out in about 10 minutes. But she went online and paid about £150, I think, to get me a ticket to go and see him in Amsterdam, because I'd moved back this time. And I went over with my £150 ticket, just me, because nobody else likes him that much to pay a fortune to go and see him. Saw him in a theatre in Amsterdam called the Carrie Theatre, which is a beautiful, old, sort of red velvet-lined theatre, absolutely perfect to see him there. And I turned up with my ticket, so excited, and I gave it to the ticket guy, this Dutch guy. And he takes one look at it and looks at me and goes, "I'm sorry, sir, this ticket is not valid."
Oh, no.
And I went, "What? Oh, no. I'm only joking. On you go." Brilliant. Nice one, mate. And it was but that gig was just absolutely incredible, because, like I said, I'd never seen him live before. I didn't know what was going on. There was no support, and I was just sat with all these other people who were so excited, and the ushers were saying that people had come from America to see this gig to Amsterdam, because just from all over the world, it was such an event. And when he walked out on the stage to sing this song for the first time, I've never experienced anything like it. The atmosphere in that place, it was just absolutely electric. And then he just held the audience for 2 hours effortlessly, with just such charisma, like coming out of a man. You've never seen anything like it. It was absolutely incredible. So that's why I picked this track, is because this incredible groove, this incredible thumping groove, is what I heard the first time when he walked out on the stage. And you hear this awesome voice. There's just nothing like it. If you hear Tom Waits' voice live, it's like, it's not human.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, a lot of the guys that you've picked here are not what you'd necessarily call mainstream pop these days.
Nope.
You know, Paul Simon might have been many years ago, but
sure,
certainly not these days regarded as a pop artist,
yep,
more of a songwriter.
Yep.
And as you just said, the cult following that these guys have and the
yep
dedicated audience that exists,
yep,
it's a massive underground part of the music business, which your sort of mainstream fan who might look to the O2 Academies and,
yep,
you know, for their gig of choice,
yep,
misses out on completely.
It's more powerful than anything, because the thing is that the following that people like me have for someone like Tom Waits, I will buy, like I said with the Rufus Wainwright, I will buy every album he produces now, unless he does something really awful, without question, I'll be there queuing up on the day to buy it. And if I can afford to see him tour, I'll go and see him tour, because I just love these guys so much. And that's something that artists who have a super quick rise to fame and play the O2 once will not have. You know, they won't have that kind of loyalty and that kind of following. And that's the only way to have any kind of longevity, really, in the music business, is to build up that following.
Yes, because if you don't collect the dedicated followers on the way up, they won't be there on the way back down.
That's true. But, I mean, it's also right in that line, though, because it's like, if you hear that the albums that Tom Waits was putting out in the 70s or whatever, I don't know if they would be given a chance in this climate now. So it's that thing. It's like, I can absolutely agree with you, but it's just, it's on the other hand, wondering if, I don't know, it's maybe a different climate now, and is it harder to get out stuff that is not going to be an instant hit, because it seems like that's what so much of the music industry is geared towards now, is the fast, you know, the quick win, is the fast book.
I don't think that's just music either, Loz. I think that's general across society as a whole, that
yeah
they want instant gratification, they want to buy into something, take what they want from it and drop it and move on to the next thing. And
that's right.
But I do still think that, you know, certainly experience of songwriting gigs at the Cellars over the last 2 or 3 years is that some people are still getting dedicated fan bases. There's a guy called Jake Morley.
Yeah.
There's another guy called Sam Gray.
Yeah.
And people are buying into these. And I mean, you'll remember Ezio, of course, who still relentlessly tour every year. They've never had a hit, but they can play pretty much any venue and pull about 100 people. And that's, you know, a really credible part of the music business.
I mean, another great example, I'd say, David Ford.
There's a great line in this Tom Waits track that you've chosen, Make It Rain, which is just another guest on this sad earth, which I think to me, you know, kind of sums up Tom Waits, really. Somebody said to me recently, what is it with Tom Waits? Does he sing, does he shout, or does he growl, right? And I said, that's his act. Yeah. All three things, you know?
Well, he does all three. And it's funnily enough, there's an album, the most recent album he released, Bad As Me, is great. But if you really want a fantastic album, the one previous to that, which is called Orphans, is outstanding. And the Orphans is a three-CD set, which is split into three albums called Ballers, Brawlers, and Bastards. And it is those three things that you just said. It's him doing these really sweet, sad melodies. It's doing these really sort of balls-out rock songs. And it's doing these things that don't fit into either of the two, where it's bizarre, sort of off-the-cuff poetry or this weird thing where he's just growling. I just love it, though. I absolutely love it. Because underpinning all of that is this phenomenal songwriting that's just so good. And it's every time I get a new Tom Waits album, I think, yeah, it's going to be fine. It's going to be good. I know I'm going to like this. But then halfway through, something will happen that just absolutely grabs you by the guts and just knocks you senseless. I don't know what it is. Obviously, if I knew, that's what I'd be doing. But it's that thing that's mysterious and incredible, and it just floors me.
Okay, Losbridge's last choice for his influences that he's put to us for the show is Fats Domino and a track called Walking to New Orleans.
Yeah.
I wasn't remotely surprised to see that in there either, and I was slightly disappointed in a way that you never put forward one of your own tracks as the Wine Song, because
right.
I think that fits in perfectly with that.
Do you know what, bizarrely enough, I haven't heard that song for years, the Wine Song, and then I listened to it like just this week. And I actually thought, you know what, that's not a bad song. So yes. I don't mean to sound big-headed, but I'd sort of written it off for a while, thinking it was just a quirky, silly little song. And then I walked to the other day, and I think that was when I was first really getting into the New Orleans piano influence.
Is it one for your Brawlers CD?
It's one for the Brawlers, yeah, exactly. But I was listening to that and thinking, no, it's not so bad. But I think I picked this song because you were asking me for my influences, and I was trying to think... I was trying to think objectively and honestly, and not just giving you people that are going to sound cool, although Fats Domino is really cool. But I was just trying to think of people that will have sort of permeated my subconscious without me knowing it. And I think I remember growing up, and when I was little, my dad was a huge fan of Fats Domino, and this kind of stuff was always playing in the house. And this is stuff that has really sort of sunk into my brain. These piano players, Fats Domino, Dr. John, and even people like Jerry Lee Lewis and these guys really have sunk into my subconscious. And just recently, over the last few years, I've really started getting into it so much more, that this style of New Orleans piano playing, which is completely unique, and a completely different style of blues piano playing. And I remember, Steve, actually, when I saw...
John Cleary,
yeah. That was absolutely phenomenal. When I saw him in the cellars with his band, The Absolute Monster Gentlemen, that was one of the most awe-inspiring sights I've ever seen, and very much similar to Fats Domino's style of piano playing. I included this song, as I say, because I just remember this stuff playing when I was little, like playing around my house, and it's definitely sunk into my brain. But this has a particular kind of beauty to it, and a real simplicity to it, Walking to New Orleans. And that really simple string part just absolutely elevates it. I think this is a stunning track.
So this is from 1960, and it was written, I think, by Bobby Charles for Fats Domino.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some kind of story that there was a song written and they had an encounter, and at which Fats had forgotten something that he needed.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, to get that, I will have to walk to New Orleans.
Oh, right.
Apparently, but you know how stories, you know, snowball.
That's right. I'm sure Fats Domino put the line, I've got my suitcase in my hand or something. I'm sure he just contributed one line to this and said, nah, that's what's really going to make it killer. I don't know how much of that is true or how much he just wanted the royalties off it, but whatever it was, it's gorgeous.
Well, amazingly, it sold over 2 million copies.
So it was a good decision.
So
to
it was
put
a good decision to put that in. I suppose when most people think about Fats Domino, they think Blueberry Hill. That's
sure.
his kind of that's his big hit, isn't it? That's the Fats.
Yeah,
song.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean that would also been a good choice, but I think I just picked this because it has something almost ethereal and really beautiful in it, and I think it's that string line that does it. And it's just, I don't know, it's an absolutely beautiful song.
Well, let's give it a spin now. And Fats Domino this year is 85 years of age.
Whoa.
Still going strong. I'm sure, Loz, you'll get there. You'll still be going at that age.
Thanks, mate. Thanks.
But this is Walking to New Orleans.
Yeah.
We're coming towards the end now of your selection of influences,
yep.
and also some of your own work, which you've selected exclusively for our show, which is great. We thank you for that.
Yep.
I'm really interested to talk to you about your voice, because you have, I think, a great voice. You use your voice. You know, it's not
okay.
Technically, it's very sound,
yep.
but it's a great voice in the sense that you use it as a weapon, as an instrument.
Oh, wow.
And I think there are a number of the tracks you put forward where you really demonstrate that you kind of you know how to use it
yeah.
to complement piano, guitar, all those kind of different things. And also in some of the duets that you put forward,
yep.
Really interesting how some of the harmonies work. I mean, I guess that's difficult to try and work with others and get the level
I absolutely love it. Harmonies is a weird thing because it does not really come naturally to me. I mentioned Andrew Foster before, and he's irritating in that he can just do harmonies effortlessly without thinking about it. It doesn't come as easily to me. I really have to work at it, but I love it. I absolutely love it, harmonies, and especially harmonies between two different people, not just when you're doing backing vocals when yourself, but I really like to find the interesting harmony, to find the what you wouldn't expect, to find some unusual harmonies. But in terms of using my voice, I think it's partly that I have learned to use it, although not consciously. I think just if you say, I've been singing like out and writing songs for well over 10 years, and I think if you just do it, you obviously start, when you start to sing, you obviously sing because you want to sing like somebody else. That's because you want to sing like your heroes. But I think after time, all of that stuff blends into one, and you become more confident with who you are and more confident with your own style, and it generally becomes your voice, which hopefully has happened now. I think I've got quite my own voice. I'm not trying to sing like anybody else. But also what's happened is, not only have I learned how to use it, but because I'm a writer, I just write songs that will sound good in my voice. And it's not, I don't necessarily consciously sit down and go, I'm going to write in this key, but I do tend to write in a lot of the same keys. And I tend to, if I sing songs, I'll write melodies that are easy for me to sing. It's just naturally what I'll do. I won't go for notes that I can't reach. Or I've learned, funnily enough, that there's certain vowel sounds that I sing well, which is quite an obscure thing, but it's when you realize it, oh yeah, if I sing this word instead of this sound, it will sound more like me, it will sound good. It's like it's more natural for me to sing certain vowel sounds. So it's nice when you realize stuff like that.
Well, let's talk about another one of your tracks, which is When the Rains Came Down,
yep.
which I think from what you've described, was it almost a throwaway song? It was almost a kind of something
yeah.
that came about by accident that was kind of maybe left or nearly left. But I'm glad it wasn't, because I've been listening to it, wow, pretty much non-stop last two or three days.
Wow.
And it has a real resonance. It's a great, great song.
This is a perfect example of don't throw things away, or don't just keep things and keep revisiting them. This song sort of came out of that period that I was talking about, when I first moved to Bristol and wasn't performing and I was just concentrating on writing. And I organised a weekend in London with a couple of mates of mine, Matt, the drummer who I mentioned before, and Dave Jones, who used to play bass for us in Suburbian, I've known for years, and he's a producer and engineer. And he was working in a studio in London at the time, and we just went up and spent a weekend and sort of picked a few songs of mine and said, let's have a jam and let's see how they turn out. And it was one of those things where just a combination of a really good atmosphere, no pressure, no stress. We weren't doing it for anything. We weren't recording for an album or anything like that. We were just getting together and jamming. And this song came out of that on a day, and all of a sudden, this sort of heavens opened, and a really thunderous downpour, like torrential downpour, came down, and I found myself like stranded in a shopping centre, and everyone just wandering around like zombies. They didn't know where to go to, and it really felt like post-apocalyptic to me. It really felt like a real sense of dread, but like nameless dread. You didn't know why. And with this awful downpour coming down around, it was just beautiful. I love moments like that where weather really takes over, and sort of came down and wrote this track. And musically, it's incredibly simple. It's only three chords or something, but I was chuffed with the way it came out.
When the rains came down, my world was enormous. Seen it, scary, and the men became monsters, and the women were witches, carnal and savage. The children were feral, and the dogs were rabid. When the rains came down, when the rain came down, when the rains came
When the rains came down, we lost time for a minute. We all became children, but nervous and giddy. We wandered like geese in a shopping mall. A rain on the window continued to pour. It was dark and empty, and cold like a headache. A charity worker outside became frantic. Do I stick to my post? Charlie, do we stick to our post? We're stranded in town when the rain came down. When the rain came down. When the rain came down. What I wouldn't give to be home. What I wouldn't give to be safe and warm. What I wouldn't give to be out. Telling the story of how when the rain came down. When the rain came down. When the rain came down.
So, Loz, what's next for Lozbridge?
It's a lot more of the same. It's a lot more songwriting. It's a lot more trying to make sort of other songwriting connections and writing songs to be pitched for TV and film. We've actually just got the guy, Beans Rudden in London, who I write a lot with, who I think we're playing a co-write with him in a second, is sort of very active in pitching songs for US TV shows. We've had a few. In fact, the song that you just heard, When the Rains Came Down, has had a lot of interest recently from music supervisors. So who knows, fingers crossed, you may be hearing that on a TV show sometime soon, but we'll see. But plenty more of that. I'm always up for trying to connect with different songwriters and getting different collaborations on the go and different sounds. But more than anything, it's just to try and write better songs. I know that sounds like quite a trite answer, but it's one of these things I've learned, that to absolutely not try and get caught up in the business side of it, or to try and get too concerned about measuring your success, because the measure of your success is how good a song you write. That's what it is. And I've always thought, if during the course of you doing what you love, you get some success out of it, that's good. But your goal has always got to be write a better song for its own sake.
So do you think you've sort of moved on from the feeling that you had a few years ago, that you weren't sure whether you wanted to continue to engage with the music business because of, you know, some, not negative experiences, but just that you didn't feel that you were connecting with people? Have you managed to sort of get that into a place where you're happy now?
I continue to sort of have like a lot of bitterness towards the music industry, not particularly because of anything that it's done to me. It's just, I just have come to the conclusion recently that if you follow that line of thought and try and get somewhere and are asking why aren't I getting stuff back, that it's a dead end and it'll damage you creatively. Yeah. And you have to constantly find ways to remind yourself that you're doing it because when it's good, it makes you feel good in a way that nothing else does. And and writing a song is a sense of achievement that you won't get from anywhere else. And if you allow that to become muddied by, you know, ambition or trying to get success out of it, then it's not a good road to go down.
So for folks that don't know Lozbridge, where would they go to find out more about him?
SoundCloud is probably the best place to go. So soundcloud.com/Lozbridge is probably the best place to go, because that's where I'll be putting new stuff and co-writes. And
excellent. Well, Loz, it's been a real pleasure to catch up with you again and talk through some of your influences and also go through your amazing back catalogue. I think we have to describe it in that way. We're going to play out, you alluded to it, we're going to play out with a song called You Saw Something in Me, which is a co-write with Beans Rudden.
Yeah.
And just tell us a little bit about that before we go.
So I've been writing with Beans now for a couple of years. It was a guy I just met online who's a producer. He's been involved in the pop side of the music industry for many years. And we've been developing songs together. And this was the one I was particularly proud of, because we've written all sorts of styles of song and different things to pitch and to sync and to write for other artists. But I think this is the one that was really simple. There's nothing particularly clever about this song at all. It's only 2.5 minutes long. It's a nice short song. And we tried to flower it up in all sorts of ways, and we just figured out that leaving it simple was the best way. And I think this song just really nails the tone of what we were after. It's lyrically very simple, musically very simple, and I think it was really on the money.
That's it for this edition of All About the Songwriter, but before we go, some up-and-coming events that you might want to catch.
Yeah, one of the things we're going to be doing with this programme is plugging interesting gigs that are coming up over the next month, and we're going to start off with the 25th of September at the Wedgwood Rooms with Liam Frey, frontman from the Cortinas. Also at the Wedge on the 29th of September, you can catch the Temperance Movement. In the Cellars in September, you can see Andrew Foster, who Losbridge was talking about quite a bit during his interview, supporting Terry Reid, and local ukulele impresario Ben Rouse will be supporting Del Rey, a well-known ukulele specialist from the United States of America. On the 29th, James himself with the Pompey Pluckers will be appearing at the Cellars at Eastneath, and that's free entry, 1 till 4. In October, the Plains, a very popular local band, good outfit those guys, and they're with us on the 5th of October at the Cellars. And on the 6th, another local band, Mr. Mountain, will be supporting the New Zealand rhythm and blues group Brillo. So watch out for all of those. And a quick plug for those of you who like to get out and about and try your skills, perhaps unlike Loz, you still like to go to open mic nights, you can catch one of those at Aspects Gallery on the first Thursday of every month over in Gunwolf Keys.
It's all good stuff. Our next guest in our October show is Becky Jerrams. You heard Loz mention her a couple of times, done some co-writing things with him. That's it for now. I've been James Sandy.
And I'll be Steve Pitt.
All About the Songwriter is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.